Hello, and welcome to our podcast. Thanks for tuning in. This is the latest in our Corcoran Consulting Group series. And in today's episode, we're going to chat about MIGS and why MIGS is such a hot topic recently in ophthalmology. My name is Fielding. I'm your host. Let's get to it. Joining me today, consultants Mary Pat Johnson and Brandy Sperry. Thank you for joining me again. And managing principal here at Medical Consulting Group, Bill Rayburn. So, MIGS. What does MIGS stand for, Brandy?
Minimally invasive glaucoma surgery.
Why is MIGS such a hot topic right now in ophthalmology?
Because there are so many different new procedures coming out for MIGS under that topic, you know, underneath that umbrella. There's a lot of different devices, a lot of different types of procedures that are coming out, which makes it a hot topic for a lot of different providers, even providers that are not glaucoma specialists. And so the volume of those procedures have increased. So it's getting a lot of attention from payers because of the increase in volume.
And MIGS doesn't refer to one type of surgery, right? There can be multiple techniques, implants and devices that would qualify as MIGS, is that correct?
That's correct. It's kind of a family of codes, somewhere between a full trabeculectomy or shunt procedure, and I guess even on the laser side, so some of those are considered minimally invasive glaucoma surgeries. But as Brandy mentioned, they are touted to be easier, so even physicians who are not subspecialty fellowship trained as glaucoma specialists can do these. And sometimes they're done in conjunction with cataract surgery, which means cataract surgeons have taken an interest in them.
Why is MIGS so important in the world of ophthalmology?
Well, I think in general, glaucoma is just unfortunately a disease that has grown in our society as our population has grown, and it's related to other comorbidities that have affected the population. So as a result, I think in the past we haven't had as many options to treat glaucoma. Now we do have additional options to treat glaucoma, and we've got a population that is significantly growing in the whole glaucoma field.
Yeah, I read online that it is the leading cause of irreversible blindness, affecting about 80 million globally per year. So I can see why this would be interesting on a coding and reimbursement standpoint, because we're expanding what qualifies as MIGS. Mm-hmm. So that would obviously grab the attention of owners and payers, especially if there are more procedures being done annually. Is that right?
That's right. And as Brandy mentioned, utilization has gone up with these. More doctors are doing them, more patients are needing them. And anytime you see a growth in the use of a code, the payers start to revisit their policies. So mid to late, maybe third quarter or so, 2023, five of the Medicare administrative contractors came out with a new proposal, which really turned reimbursement for MIGS upside down. And some of it was really going to be difficult for providers to really deal with. Procedures they've been doing for many years now were going to be non-covered in many circumstances. Luckily, they put all that on hold, but I think they're still looking at this kind of, it's in flux to see where it's going to end and which procedures we can do. You also need to consider the definitions of the codes. You know, sometimes they want to do more than one procedure at a given OR session. You have to look at the codes. Does that allow that? Do the bundles allow that? Does the patient need that? So it's not as easy as just picking, say, a cataract code and going to the OR for one procedure.
And I read even in 2022 there was an update. So are these updates pretty frequent?
Well, they hadn't been until about 2022, but again, when you see the growth, when utilization goes up, a couple things happen. Reimbursement oftentimes goes down, and scrutiny goes right up along with it.
Mm-hmm. How do people keep up? What resources are available to avoid inappropriate billing for this new MIGS update?
They can always take a look at their Medicare administrative contractors' policies to make sure that they are billing appropriately based on those Medicare policies. Also, Corcoran Consulting Group is a great resource, too, if you have any questions about any of your billing for any of your procedures, not just MIGS. We'd be glad to help with any of those questions.
So the payment rates changed for 2024?
They did, and from the physician standpoint, Medicare's fee schedule in general went down almost 3%, 2.4 or 2.8%. Some of the glaucoma procedures took a slightly stronger decrease than that, depending on RVU changes. But the good news is on the surgery center side, some of these got pretty sizable increases. So those providers who own an ASC or have interest in an ASC are going to be pleased to hear that.
Is MIGS appropriate for all patients who have glaucoma?
Probably not every patient who has glaucoma. I mean, there are standards that payers or providers are expected to follow, and they kind of a least invasive, most effective treatment plan. So currently in the United States, under reimbursement rules, most payers expect we're going to start with eye drops to control glaucoma. We're seeing the next step, which would be like an SLT laser, being introduced a little sooner now than it historically has been. Patients aren't left on drops, particularly multiple drops, for years and years. But they have to at least try, because the package labeling for these devices usually say indications include failed therapeutic options. So drops probably to start with, or SLT sometimes might be the first, maybe not always, but early on. And then once that has proven to not be successful, perhaps go to a MIGS. But yet they do have to read the device package insert as to what's expected prior to moving to surgery.
What could be the problem with just leaving glaucoma patients on drops only?
So the problem with that would be, number one, cost for those drops can get very expensive. A lot of insurance companies change their policies based on, you know, tiers for each of the medications. Also, the drop side effects can be a problem for the surface of the cornea. It causes redness, causes irritation. A lot of patients just cannot tolerate those types of side effects for those drops. So sometimes it's better to remove those patients from those drops and then start with either doing an SLT or if they've failed an SLT, doing MIGS procedures on them instead.
Is there ever any issue surrounding patient compliance?
Absolutely. So not only would it be like we talked about earlier with the drop pricing and side effects, it could be the fact that the patient just physically can't get the drops in the eye. So arthritis, you know, the drops can be hard to squeeze, you know, any kind of mobility issues can cause the patient just not to be able to get the drops in. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a compliance issue too.
And one of the concerns with eye drops, and I think with medicine in general, is if the patient is asymptomatic, they might not feel they need the medication. Mm. And I remember being in clinic and patients, because they were expensive and they didn't feel better or worse if they took them, they might cut their dose in half, you know, save a little money, extend the life of that bottle, and not realizing that even though they didn't feel different, the eye was, you know, responding accordingly. You're not getting enough medicine in. But that's not just in ophthalmology. We do that with all kinds
of meds. Yeah, antibiotics, you know, all that.
Yeah. Is glaucoma always symptomatic?
Yeah, I think glaucoma is not symptomatic always.
It's been nicknamed the silent thief of sight because it really does, it's just a very slow, diminished visual field. And I don't tell patients fairly progressed glaucoma, they don't really notice it.
Yeah, the one bad thing about glaucoma is that you don't know you have it until you start losing vision. And then once that's gone, there's no real getting that back.
Yeah, and it's very hereditary.
Yes, it is. There's a hereditary component.
You know what I mean? If you've got family members that have glaucoma, you need to get in and get checked. And that's why it's recommended that we, you know, you get in and get a good eye exam yearly.
Some of the advancement in our capabilities and technology is probably around this preventative stage of this disease. So it sounds like there's a preventative element here, where you don't want to wait, you need to go in and get checked.
Yeah, I don't think I'd use the word preventative, but I do think early detection.
Early detection.
Yeah, which is really just going to be picked up on a prophylactic, I'm here just to be checked,
yeah,
you know, because of family history.
Yeah, and if you do have family history, you want to definitely make sure that you have an eye exam, you know, once a year, and you want to make sure that they're doing a visual field on you because, you know, you may not have any symptoms, and the only way that you may notice that you have any kind of decrease in your peripheral vision is with a visual field test.
You know, I think we always think of, especially younger people, and you know, we all think of ourselves as young, right? Mm-hmm. But we think, oh, well, as long as I can see well, you know, I can see to drive at night, I can read the paper, you know, whatever the case may be. I'm good, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't, because there's no symptoms, and maybe we haven't found out from our family, you know, do we have a family history? We just assume that we're good to go. That's not the case.
And share that family history with your eye doctor. It is important that they know that, because they can schedule the appropriate tests or do some testing that will see subclinical changes, scans of the optic nerve for things you don't see just by looking in the eye.
A standard exam might not be enough.
It's a good start. I mean, they'll take a couple measurements. They'll measure the pressure. They'll take a peek at the optic nerve if anything looks unusual. But they might look a little more keenly if they know you have a family history or, some tests that are an eye that maybe wouldn't have gotten a test without a glaucoma relationship might get a test once they understand that mom and dad or aunt or uncle also had this condition. Mm-hmm. So just, be your own advocate. Tell them what you are in for. The family history of glaucoma is a perfect chief complaint.
Right.
How often are these policies revisited?
Oh, that would be wonderful if we had an answer. So the payers really can do it whenever they like. Medicare, until we got into this MIGS arena, generally would let some policies go several years between revisiting them. This, because it's a hot topic, we've seen changes occur within a few months from some. And then to add a little more complication, the non-Medicare payers are on their own schedule. So this needs some attention at the practice level to really stay on top of their big payers and check periodically, has there been an update? We've done that for some clients. We've got some information, so we can certainly share that if anyone doesn't have time to do their own research into what their Medicare administrative contractor is doing. And not all payers even have a policy, but those that do change up whenever they get time.
So, Mary Pat, Brandy, if my practice is doing a fair amount of MIGS, and I have a question about how should we be handling it today, just a quick phone call to you guys can help my billing team get that squared away.
Yeah, absolutely. We can answer any questions. We can look up your Medicare administrative contractor's policy and let you know based on your particular practice what the regulations are.
So they can start with you and go from there.
Yes. Yeah.
Awesome.
And so that's really the position we prefer to be in, get the question up front. Unfortunately, in the last 5 or 6 months, we've gotten a lot of denials, upset practice. Now what do I do? And some of them were reversible. The claim just had an error, but other, they were working against the way their policy was written, but they proceeded with the surgery procedure without asking for the information up front. So if we had our choice, we'd rather have the question before we stumble down the wrong path.
But if my practice is having trouble getting reimbursed, you can help me kind of sort through, what might be the problem, so I can decide, do I want to resubmit or refile the claim?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if it truly was just an issue on the claim, we had something in the wrong box, we used the wrong code, those are easily fixable. But if you've done something that is, contrary to the policy, either indications or frequency or off-label use of the device, those are harder to get to convince the payer to handle.
Mm-hmm. How do I stay current with all the changes in the policies?
Wouldn't it be nice if you had just a full-time person for that?
Right.
It's difficult. You're running a big organization. Excuse me. There's HIPAA, there's HR, there's marketing, there's patient care. And yet you still need someone tasked in the office to do this. So we're here to help, and professional societies have some information. The vendors have some information. Just make sure that it's well vetted and where they got their resources. But this is one that I think we're going to be into for a while before all the payer policies kind of level out, and then we'll have a more consistent answer.
And I definitely think that having one person, that's kind of tasked to, in your practice, to make sure that they check on these periodically, once every, 3 months, once a quarter, something like that, to make sure that there's no changes. Just because, like Mary Pat said, these policies can change at any time, and they're not going to call you up and say, hey, we changed our policy,
right.
So just having somebody tasked in your office to have to check those periodically is probably a great place to start too.
The onus falls on the practice to comply.
Yes.
So having a point person that is focused and giving attention to how to properly implement and execute these updates is probably a best practice suggestion, rather than having everyone kind of in or out trying to understand these updates, but having one person that's dedicated to these updates.
I think one person is probably going to be more consistent. Mm-hmm. You know, if we make this a team effort, we're all going to presume someone else on the team did it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I would put someone in charge. And whether they do it themselves or delegate it, they're still responsible for checking the box that this quarter I verified. Mm-hmm. And not every payer, because each doctor's office probably works with dozens, if not more, insurance plans. But you at least want to hit the big ones, the ones who send you a fair volume of business.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might stumble upon a policy that, or a payer that doesn't have a policy. And you can sub in as an example. Well, you didn't give me an instruction on this, but we went to a reliable source. We didn't just make it up. We're following Medicare's instructions. We thought that was probably what you wanted. And the payer without a published policy will likely agree to that.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like these coding and reimbursement updates are frequent and are going to require some focused attention to properly implement and execute. If you or your practice needs help, the Corcoran website is a great place to start. Thank you to Mary Pat, Brandy, and Bill. Your insights are valuable as always. We will be attending ASCRS next month in Boston. Please reach out if you are also attending. And thank you for listening. We hope you learned something today. Till next time.